Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. When thinking of World War II, the attack on Pearl Harbor, as well as the theaters in Europe and the South Pacific, may come to top of mind. But an author based in Dixon devoted research to telling a neglected piece of World War II. Aleutian veterans deployed to the islands off the Alaskan mainland that were the only North American territory invaded and occupied during the war. And many of those soldiers never returned home. Bill Paul is that author and a veteran himself. He joins us now to discuss his new book, Awaiting the Sun, World War II Veterans Remember the Aleutians. Welcome, Bill.
Good morning.
I learned a great deal preparing for this conversation. First, just the location of the Aleutian Islands and how vast it is. It spans roughly the distance from like San Diego to the California-Oregon border. It's like some 800, 900 miles. It has 14 large, but also 55 small islands off the Alaskan mainland. But the distance that I was surprised to learn from your book after two of these islands were invaded, the outermost islands, was one of strategy. You know, that was actually strategy for these islands, which were dangerously positioned between Japan and the U.S. mainland.
Yes. You know, a lot of people don't realize, unless they take a flight from, say, San Francisco to Japan, that the shortest route actually goes right over the Aleutian Islands. If you look at a globe, you can easily see that that's the shortest route. So a lot of the American military planners during the war were really quite concerned when the Japanese invaded and occupied two of these islands, because if they had gone further east, perhaps into the Alaska mainland and so on, they would have been within bombing distance of Seattle and even San Francisco. And there were a lot of military facilities in those two places. So they were really concerned strategy-wise. And also, the Japanese occupying some of the Aleutian Islands might have prevented some war material from coming from American sources into Russia. We were actively supporting Russia at that time.
At what point during the war were these two islands invaded and occupied?
It was a lot of people are familiar with the Battle of Midway, which was a turning point in the war for America. That's the point at which we decisively defeated the Japanese fleet. And at the very same time, I don't know the exact year and month, but at the very same time, some of the Japanese fleet went up to the Aleutian Islands. And it's still debated today if it was just a diversionary effort or if they actively set out to occupy and invade those two islands.
And there were soldiers who were deployed, you know, to protect the Aleutian Islands. And the first thing that came to my mind when thinking of this area off the Alaskan coast was the weather. And you kind of confirmed my assumption. You said some of the worst weather in any theater of World War II.
That's very true. And it's said that we lost more men and airplanes and material and ships due to the weather than we did to the Japanese, because that area up there is often called the cradle of storms. And a lot of the storms that we have right here in Oregon and California originate in that area up there. The weather up there is god-awful to specify.
You could probably count on one hand the days of where it's actually mild or reasonable or comfortable.
Well, that's where part of the title of the book comes from, Awaiting the Sun, because the sun was so rarely seen up there. It was foggy, cloudy, raining, snowing, sleeting. And I remember hearing that in the outermost island, Attu, that they only had 6 days a year where the sky was completely blue.
Wow.
And sunny. So the weather up there was really awful.
Yeah, not to mention remote as well. I mean, where did this all begin for you? It began with your father, correct, this journey?
Yes, my father was a teacher. And to this day, I don't know if he was actually drafted or enlisted, but he was trained to be an officer in the Navy in communications. And so he was assigned to go up to Adak Island, which was a major, major staging area and post in the islands. It's about halfway out. And so I heard stories from him, you know, from time to time over the years, but I didn't actively start on this book project until after he died, and I truly, truly regret not hearing more stories from him about how it was. But he was also concerned sometimes because he worked in communications and they worked in code work and so on. A lot of those folks were told not to say anything about their work. And I think that he held to that almost to his death. It's kind of ridiculous, but they took an oath and they went to it.
And you were able to retell a lot of these stories through an extensive amount of research that you did and you know, even, I think, diary entries. And although, because a lot of these people are no longer alive, you were able to retell their experiences, their personal ones. How many GIs were based in Alaska at the height of the war? Because you write that the population in Alaska nearly doubled between 1940 and 1950.
Yeah, the military, I think, has always had a big impact on Alaska, but especially during World War II. And, you know, I've found it very difficult to get exact numbers on the number of GIs up there. I've heard that in Alaska as a whole, there were about 45,000 GIs up there at the height of the war. And I was just reading something yesterday that put the figure at 100,000. But there were a lot of men up there, and there are a lot of relatives still to this day who really don't know much about how their service was up there, what they had to face, what their jobs were, and so on. So I think this book kind of deals to that.
Yeah. You also write that many didn't return home. What did you learn about the fate of these young men that were deployed?
Well, the most loss of life happened when the Americans retook the island of Attu. And it was a very difficult proposition for the Army to do that because they'd never done an amphibious landing before. They brought troops up that had been trained in the Californian desert to serve in Africa. It was that bad. They weren't prepared for the weather at all. It was pretty bad. We lost about 600 men on Attu. That was the major loss of life. But there were also other just plain airplane accidents. They flew into mountains. You know, it's a volcanic chain. They flew into mountains. The navigational aids were pretty poor at that time. There were men lost on ships. The terrific storms up there, ships just disappeared. So, it was tough duty, and men lost their lives.
You know, given everything that we're learning, why do you think the Aleutian Islands is a neglected piece of World War II history? And many Americans maybe know little about what happened.
Yeah, you know, the prime emphasis, what people heard about in World War II in the Pacific were the action in the tropics, Guadalcanal, Okinawa, you know, all those islands. They were skipping from island to island, and it was major news. But very few people heard about what was happening in the Aleutians. In fact, there was a lot of censorship going on by the government at that time. They didn't want Americans at first to even know that the Japanese had invaded and occupied a couple of islands that were part of American territory. Censorship was extreme, and I devoted a whole chapter to that. Mm-hmm. Guys sending letters home to their parents were heavily censored. They could say, well, I'm on an island or something. They didn't want photos sent home that would indicate where they were serving. The censorship was really extreme.
Do you think that actually trickled down to, you know, Aleutian soldiers actually being neglected when compared to other soldiers in more attention-grabbing theaters like Europe and the South Pacific?
Definitely, yeah. I'm glad that I could do this book. And one thing I'd like to emphasize is that there are a number of books done about the war up there, but they were done early on before the best book, which is The Thousand Mile War, was done around 1970. And books were done after that. But I had the advantage of doing my book after the advent of the internet. And all of the beautiful interviews that were done by professionals and even high school students or college students, just tons of material on the internet that I was able to tap. So my book opens up a whole new, I guess you say, chapter on the war because of all these interviews. And I'm able more to portray the daily lives of the soldiers up there, how it was, what they did with their time. Were they depressed? What did they do? There's just some great stories in there.
Yeah, you know, you just think about people who are barely adults and probably never even left their hometown and being sent, you know, to what feels like the middle of nowhere, you know, off Alaska. And just learning from your writing and your research that even when it comes to shelter, I mean, the stability of shelter really depended on how far west you were stationed. And it could vary greatly whether you were on the mainland in Anchorage or if you were in, I think it's like Amchitka? Like, I mean, because as we said, those islands are like 800 to 900 miles in distance from each other.
Yes. You know, the weather up there was bad. And constant wind, cold, sleet, rain, everything that nature could throw at you was being done there, even blizzards in the winter. But guys spent the whole time up there, maybe 2 or 3 years, living in a tent where it was snowing. And that was pretty bad working conditions. And one thing I say in the book is, I devoted another chapter to this, is the Navy versus the Army. The Navy would get their Quonset huts a lot sooner than the Army. Some of the Army guys never saw a Quonset hut. They were living in tents. So, yeah, and then the winds would blow the tents away. The mess hall might be in a tent. It was pretty difficult, the tent living.
It definitely, I would imagine, helped you visualize better your father's service in World War II. Did you find any parallels to your service in Vietnam?
Well, you know, it's such a 180-degree difference, because I lived in a tent in Vietnam where the problem, of course, was the heat and humidity, you know. I had the only fan in my tent, electric fan. So I was a popular guy, because when I left the tent, somebody else would get to use it. But so much difference between the two. I think that up there, you know, back then in Alaska during the war, the only real method of communication with folks back home is by letter. And I'm a Postal Service employee, so that was kind of a subject that was dear to my heart. I devoted another chapter to that. In Vietnam, we could make occasional phone calls, and I'm a ham radio guy, so actually there was a ham radio station where I was based where you could get on the air, and the guy would contact somebody back in the States who was a ham, and they would hook you up to a telephone. So technologically, things were a lot more advanced, and we had, you know, the food was much better. We had a library there that was air-conditioned, fortunately, and it was just a lot easier. Of course, I wasn't involved in the actual combat in Vietnam. I was a pencil pusher. But things were just much, much better there. The quality of life was better despite the heat.
Well, Bill, thank you so much for doing all this work and starting, you know, what is like a new chapter to learning about a neglected piece of World War II in North America.
Well, thanks for letting me talk about it.
Yep, I learned a great deal. That is Dixon-based author Bill Paul discussing his new book, Awaiting the Sun, World War II Veterans Remember the Aleutians. And we have a link to Bill's book on our Insight page. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, you can email us, insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producers Nick Dobis and Victor Corral Martinez, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and he's also engineering today's show. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.